This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We're going to start out with Senator Pappas's bill sent file 1101.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We have a PowerPoint that we're going to show you. And this is, we have an omnibus trafficking bill, which is Senate file 1050. But for ease of consideration, we've issued some separate bills that have to do with committee-specific provisions. And so this is Senate File 1101, which is in relation to MFIP and human trafficking victims. Okay, that's our second slide. Just a little background. Minnesota is actually recognized as a leader in combating violence against women and girls. And since 2005, Minnesota law has recognized that a person can be trafficked by any means. It doesn't require force, fraud, and coercion like with the federal bill, and it doesn't require that you have to pass international boundaries or state boundaries or urban boundaries. So, I mean, that does happen that people are trafficked from Minneapolis to St. Paul, but it's not a requirement. The Advocates for Human Rights took up the trafficking cause and published the Sex Trafficking Needs Assessment in September 2008. During that process, they interviewed 175 individuals, including law enforcement officers, judges, prosecutors, and service providers. They complemented their qualitative information with Office of Justice Program statistical reports that are made to the Minnesota Legislature. Then how was the bill developed? The Statewide Human Trafficking Task Force Legislative Committee held several meetings from October through December in 2008 to discuss a comprehensive bill, and then in January, the Statewide Human Trafficking Task Force endorsed the comprehensive bill. There's two policy provisions that are behind the bill. The first is that sex trafficking is a form of slavery and involuntary servitude that result in grave human rights violations. And the second policy is that the state of Minnesota has a responsibility to protect trafficked persons, prosecute sex traffickers and patrons, and prevent further acts of sex trafficking. Now I'm going to turn over the presentation to you, to Mary Ellison from the Advocates for Human Rights.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm from the Advocates for Human Rights. I wanted to talk about the sex trafficking risk factors because all of these risk factors relate to why we have put together this bill for Minnesota Family Investment Program's benefits for trafficking victims. The risk factors that we have discovered through doing our needs assessment for the state of Minnesota are those you see listed here on the slide: poverty, youth, race, history of abuse, lack of resources, chemical dependency, lack of support systems, and lack of immigration status. All of these things put an individual at risk for being trafficked. So the question is, why do trafficking victims need public benefits? Well, it's for the same reason that many other individuals need public benefits. It's to stabilize their lives and their children's lives. It's to assist them in moving forward with plans for education and jobs, and to help them get to a point where cooperation in prosecuting the traffickers is possible. One of the things that we found in doing our sex trafficking needs assessment is that trafficking victims need a lot of assistance to get to the point where they can cooperate with prosecution. And creating a safety net is really an important piece of that. So I wanted to present one of our speakers today who will tell you how her story and how it is related to a need for public benefits. So I'd like to introduce Joy Friedman, and she is a staff person at an organization in St. Paul called Breaking Free.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. It's real important. I am a woman who has been through prostitution, human trafficking, and terroristic torture. Trying to get out of the life of prostitution isn't as easy as people want to say it is. I mean, when you're talking about trying to escape from, your traffickers as well as try to begin a new life, how do you go about that? Excuse me. Things that I needed when I was trying to get out of this life were a place to go to that was safe. One, you don't have any money, so how do you begin that journey? Now, we know assistance, when you go to it, you go through a whole process that can be really excruciating mentally as well as physically. To have services provided for you, such as a housing opportunity with financial assistance to get into that place, is a big need. When it comes to me trying to figure all that out, I couldn't even begin to think about how to find a place, obtain it, get the cash, then get my kids in there, do the schooling, all that. While I was thinking about money. So one of the things that I find, working with the population as well as being a survivor of this, is that I need to help these women take that burden piece out by finding services for them. If you don't qualify for assistance, what do you do and where do I take her? There's no money out here, as we all know. So when it comes to trying to rebuild your life, you have to begin with the basics, which are housing. It's just the bottom line. How do you begin to rebuild if you don't even know where you're going to rest your head, let alone your children's head? And when it comes to taking care of that financially, we need assistance, and we need it quickly, not through the old way of waiting months to months, because this woman has to survive, and they only have a split second to get out of this life, which may be that day she comes and speaks to us or that the law enforcement brings her to us, and we need to be able to provide those services for her with sufficient time, you know, with enough time that day versus 2 months from now. So I really think it's important that we take a look at trying to have this tool available for us to assist the women as well, because these are things that weren't there when I was trying to get out. It could have made my life a lot easier had there been things such as these tools we're asking for. I struggled. I struggled hard. I tried to do 3 jobs, and it was very hard because of the mental things I was going through as well as the physical, the abuse. I hadn't even begun to heal, and here I had to take on jobs. I had to look at my children and try to be a parent. You cannot mentally deal with this, let alone the physical healing pieces that are going here. We need to have something to fall back on. We need to have the same opportunities that a battered woman has when we bring her out. We assist and aid. We are battered. We are women that are being abused. We are no different. The same tactics are used in power and control, which we have shown over time and time again in our presentations and everything else. So definitely, we need help to do this job that I do now that is very, very crucial to the recovery of a mother trying to regain her life and her children and be a productive citizen without being involved in prostitution.
Thank you for sharing your story.
So you are probably asking how many sex trafficked persons or prostituted persons are affected. The Office of Justice Program with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety has put out studies in 2006, 2007, and 2008 where they have surveyed service providers and nurses as to how many trafficking victims they have served. And these statistics come from their report. So I'll just summarize the statistics here. But in 2008, where you see the numbers that say current, 1 current, 210 current, and 64 current, adding all those together, we have 275 sex trafficking victims as of that year. That would have been the year 2008 that were reported from service providers. Now, one of the things we know about sex trafficking is that it is difficult for the victims to come forward. So those victims are ones that were willing and able enough to talk about their story with the service providers that they were speaking with to identify themselves as sex trafficking victims. Labor trafficking victims in 2008, the number was 39. So the 5 current plus the 32 plus the 2. And so adding the labor trafficking victims together with the sex trafficking victims, we're talking about 314 people in 2008 that service providers identified as either labor trafficking or sex trafficking victims. Now, the number of those that would, the number of those that would have also have children would be a lesser, would be a smaller number than 314 that would be the type of person that would be seeking the MFIP assistance. One other statistic that I wanted to point out is that the Minnesota Department of Health commissioned a study called The Costs of Sexual Violence. And in that study, it showed that sexual assault costs Minnesota $8 billion in 2005, and it was likely that that didn't even include the sexual exploitation and forms of prostitution that we're talking about here. So the question is, it's costing the state of Minnesota $8 billion. How much would it cost us to provide MFIP to 314 individuals or fewer than that? The cost, really what we're talking about is we're making an investment in providing a safety net for sex trafficking victims that would then help us in not having to bear that $8 billion cost, because we know that sex trafficking victims do experience sexual assault and many other types of violence against them. So what are the issues with the law as it currently stands? Currently, the law does provide a definition which allows victims of sex trafficking to receive MFIP. However, it's the federal law that MFIP references, and the federal law has a different definition than the Minnesota law. So what we're suggesting is that in addition to the federal law, we think that's important because the federal law does define a sex trafficking victim and those victims do need to qualify for assistance. However, we need to also look at the Minnesota law and make sure that we're also allowing those that fit the Minnesota definition of sex trafficking to apply for MFIP. What we know is that oftentimes the non-foreign national victims fall through the cracks and that the funding as it currently stands is insufficient and narrowly restricted to this only the category of sex trafficking victims as it's defined under the federal law. And these quotations come from our sex trafficking needs assessment, which have shown that that some of those points that I just made. So one is policymakers have justified excluding U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents based on the mistaken notion that these groups are already eligible for public benefits. U.S. citizens may be wrongfully excluded from the services due to misconceptions. And service providers repeatedly told us in the process of doing this report that there was a lack of funding for public benefits. So our bill that we have proposed, and as Senator Pappas said, that bill was drafted in a committee over several months, and it was addressed the gaps that we found in the needs assessment. The MFIP provisions that we have created are modeled after the family violence waiver, and we have with us today Ben Weiss from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, and he is one of the attorneys who reviewed the MFIP provisions that we drafted. He is an expert and has been working for 8 years on providing legal assistance to those who are using the family violence waiver. So I thought it might be helpful to just briefly describe what the family violence waiver is, and then we can look in more detail at the text of the bill about the human trafficking waiver that we created that is modeled after it. Ben?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Weiss. I'm an attorney with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services.
Put the mic a little closer.
And obviously many of you are intimately familiar with the provisions of the Family Violence Waiver, but to be very brief, it essentially does three things. First of all, MFIP participants who receive the family violence waiver are moved into the Family Stabilization Program out of the main MFIP program, which accomplishes two things. It removes them from the federal work participation rate that the state has to report, which means that in providing the specialized services that these participants need, there's no risk to the federal funding that Minnesota and the counties receive. It also exempts them from some of the particular employment services requirements that are mandated by federal law, so that in developing their employment plans, the particular needs of moving that population to self-sufficiency can be better served without some of the particularly stringent paperwork requirements. The second thing that the Family Violence Waiver does is there are particular requirements for developing the employment plan that all participants are required to have. In addition to the normal county job counselor, the plan must be developed in conjunction with a person who's received some specialized training in the area of domestic violence and the dynamics of domestic violence, in order to make sure that the plan is developed doesn't put the participant in a position where they might have to jeopardize their safety. And the plan by law has to place the safety of the participant and the participant's children as the first priority. The third thing that a family violence waiver does is it provides, and this is directly out of the federal enabling legislation, is it provides an extension, it provides an exemption from the 60-month TANF time limit. If a person is within their first 60 months and gets a family violence waiver, the months in which they are under the waiver working with the person trained in domestic violence under the specialized plan do not count against the time limit. And if they have already used up their 60 months, they can qualify for an extension as long as they are complying with the requirements of the family violence waiver. So that's what the existing waiver does, and the intention is that the human trafficking waiver would do the exact same thing for this population.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you
Excuse
have...
Excuse me a second.
Oh,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Weiss, you know, in reading the language in Section 4 on page 3, I find it confusing. And the new language that's included there, where the person has to be a victim of family violence or human trafficking, makes us read as if they have to be actually, if they haven't, this isn't a past tense occurrence, it's a current tense occurrence, so that they actually would be involved in human trafficking at the moment. Now, I can understand where that might work in the month in which they apply, but if it's intended to be for a longer period than that, obviously you wouldn't be in compliance with a SAFE plan and also be a victim of human violence at the same time. So I think this maybe needs to be cleaned up a little bit.
Thank you for that suggestion. In terms of the other provisions that are in the law, you have before you a memo that was prepared by Senate Counsel and Research that explains each of the provisions. The slides that I have here essentially mirror that memo. So we have eight different sections in the bill, and they essentially do what Mr. Weiss explained. Section 1 modifies the MFIP division or definition of human trafficking, and that is, and I mentioned this earlier, to include both the federal definition of human trafficking, which it already does, that's already in the statute, but also adds language on page 1, lines 1.15 to 1.19, and then also in under labor trafficking, it adds our Minnesota definition under lines 2.1 through 2.5 on page 2. So we are ensuring that trafficking victims, that we're looking at both the federal and the state law. The next provision, section 2, which is 256J.32 subdivision 4. It's the same requirement that is currently in the statute for verifying that a person is a domestic violence victim. The same parallel would exist then for verifying that somebody is a human trafficking victim. And the county would have to verify that when somebody is applying for MFIP. In section 3, 256J.32 subdivision 8 allows the county agency to accept a signed personal statement. And this is, again, the same standard of proof that an individual would have to bring forward when they're claiming a family, want to have a family violence waiver, that they would be able to submit a signed personal statement. And then in section 4, 256J.42 subdivision 4, that is the piece that Mr. Weiss explained about having the months under a human trafficking waiver would not count towards the 60-month limit on assistance. That is to address the need that Ms. Friedman talked about, that oftentimes people need support and it may not fall within our neat categories of 60 months. The next section, section 5, 256J.425 subdivision 3, modifies the language to ensure that the hardship extension is available to a trafficking victim. Section 6 requires that the county or a person trained in human trafficking help an individual trafficking victim to develop their employment plan. That person would be, like in the domestic violence situation, that person would be trained in human trafficking and be able to assist the person in developing their plan that is specific to them and takes into account their unique needs. Section 7 establishes the human trafficking waiver, which is modeled after the family violence waiver. And finally, Section 8 expands the family stabilization services to include someone who has received a human trafficking waiver. So that is those are the proposals that we are making, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
So I would have a suggested language change to page 3, section 4, and Ms. White can read it to you.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 3, lines 28 and 29, delete the new language. And on line 30, after subdivision 3, insert or subdivision 3A. What that'll do is it'll take away the fact that the person has to be a victim of family violence in that month. And then it just cross-references the human trafficking safety plan, so they have to be in compliance with that plan.
Could you repeat that?
What's the new language?
Oh, I have
an old draft.
It would be after after subdivision 3, just add or subdivision
3. Oh, Madam Chair, members, it's page 3, lines 33 and 34. Delete the new language. And on page 4, line 1, after subdivision 3, insert or subdivision 3A.
Okay.
Sorry.
Senator Berglund moves that amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion of the bill?
I'll move the bill for Senator Pappas as amended.
Senator,
I believe it needs to go to the Finance Committee.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1101 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any discussion? Anybody in the audience who needed to speak to this bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Chairman
Senator
and members. Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 422 is a bill that will sort of clean up and make more workable our family stabilization program as it relates to the work requirements that are in the MFIP law. And I'd like to have Jessica Webster from Legal Services go through the changes and kind of explain how it would make things work better.
Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid represents thousands of low-income people across the state with free legal services. As Senator Berglund said, we view a number of these changes as technical, and what prompted a number of these policy changes to family stabilization services were that we saw that we had low-income families that were going to their county offices that were eligible for family stabilization services, but maybe they had an old doctor's note or some kind of old documentation that was not sufficing for current documentation that was required by the county. And the county workers' hands are really tied because they do need current documentation to put someone in family stabilization services and in many times to remove a sanction or to lift a sanction and take a family out of sanction. So what a number of provisions in this bill do say that if the county worker does have information that a person might be eligible for family stabilization services, they can put the person on that track, put the person in the program, and then help the person get the current documentation that they need. So those are the provisions that have to do with our Family Stabilization Services program. There are two other components to this bill that are separate from Family Stabilization Services. One would allow MFIP participants to be engaged in or enrolled in four-year education programs rather than two-year programs. This was, only allow people to be in two-year programs because of an old federal regulation, and that regulation has since changed. And then the other component would be that we would allow MFIP participants who are coming to the end of their time limit who are engaged in unpaid work to also be eligible for an extension.
Questions from members of the committee, from member of the committee. Oh, you're back there too. Okay. Are there any questions from members of the committee? If not, is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak to the bill? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 422 be recommended pass and referred to Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate File 481.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 481 does really three things. One, it eliminates the food stamp asset test, which was raised a few years ago, but it would make the processing and administration of programs much simpler if we abolished it, and most states have abolished it, and we're allowed to abolish it. So that's what this would do. And the funding for the food stamp program, of course, is federal. So there would be no fiscal impact to the state. The second provision extends the 60-month time limit for up to 2 years for individuals who have reached the 60-month limit. And the reason for this provision is because of the economy. Really, people in the MFIP program are not very likely to find a job over this period of time when we're in such a terrible recession. And so it isn't really fair to them to say, you know, you can't be on the program anymore. These families and children need this assistance during this very difficult time. Mr. Chair, I might just also mention that while I don't have an amendment today, we are also costing out the idea of stopping the clock for individuals so that during this period of time when it's very difficult to find a job, people wouldn't be using up their five-year limit. But this provision, as it is in the bill right now, would simply say that if you've used up your five-year limit, you're not going to, for the next 2 years, be exited from the program. And then the final thing is repealing the family cap. This is an issue you've had in this committee before, and so I won't go into a lot of detail about it. It's a provision in our law which is somewhat discriminatory based on cultural or religious differences. There are people here to testify on the bill. Mr. Chairman, if you want to call on them at
sure.
this time.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. I just have a couple of brief common sense points, trying not to repeat what Senator Berglund said. On that time limit issue, I just want to point out that, you know, welfare is the unemployment program for low-income families. Oftentimes, we're the last hired and the first to be let go. Oftentimes, it's really hard to build up the work quarters needed to qualify for unemployment benefits when you're coming from a situation of living far, far below the poverty level, often with special needs in the family. It's hard to hold on to it's hard to build up enough hours to get the unemployment. So in this time period, welfare, we need the moratorium on the time limit. Otherwise, people will have nothing and nowhere to go. Second, on the food stamp asset limit, just the simple common sense thing there is we should not, for example, have to cash out our life insurance policies in order to get food stamps. More and more middle-income families are going to be formerly middle-income families are falling into the need for food stamps, and there's no reason to make everyone lose everything just to get that meager food assistance. And finally, on the family cap, it essentially punishes babies for being born. Adding a fourth person to the grant increases the grant by $87. That's not enough to raise a child. Babies happen, and babies should be cherished and not punished. And I know this is not the place to talk about funding, but there is the TANF fund, and that would more than adequately cover these provisions that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Virginia Weldon. I am with the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout, as well as the Welfare Rights Committee. I was forced to be on infant, a mother of two, medical barriers, which forced me out of a job, and going through domestic violence issues. For 4 years, I was in an intense job searching. I filled out over 100 applications, but only got 4 interviews with no offers of full or part-time. My last 5 months on infant, I was forced to work for free, and this was before we were in the economic crisis, just so I can get my infant grant. When the time came that the company I worked for needed a part-time administrative assistant, I was let go, and they hired a Caucasian woman for the same position I was already doing. That is why I ask you to extend the infant time limit because, as you know, infant recipients are the last hired, first fired. In this economic crisis, there's no way we can compete and get a job. There are so many out of work. We shouldn't be forced to use up our time limit in a time of economic crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Linden. Senator Berglund, you mentioned earlier that the idea of somebody, that, in effect, if they're, instead of the version you have on the 60-month time limit extension, you mentioned an alternative, or was that in addition to this that?
No, it would be an alternative.
Okay.
So and we're getting it priced out, so okay. We could do it either way, but I can't have both things in the same bill, so I would like to get them both priced out.
Okay. And it's unclear which would be more expensive, is it?
I believe stopping the clock would be more expensive.
There are questions from members of the committee. Discussion. Anybody in the audience need to speak to the bill? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 481 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Yes. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 480 is a simple to explain bill. All it does is repeal the housing penalty we have under MFIP, which was enacted in 2003 during the budget cuts. We basically said that if you live in public housing or have a Section 8 voucher, you get penalized in your MFIP grant by $50 a month. And I think we're the only state that does this. We're the only state that has such a penalty. And public housing is for somebody who's of low income is supposed to be something that helps them with their ability to afford basic essentials, including housing, and to have that take away from their MFIP doesn't make a lot of sense. And I have Al Hester from the St. Paul Public Housing Agency here to testify.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Mr. Hester, you're here to testify. If you could say your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony, it'd be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Al Hester. I work for the St. Paul Public Housing Agency, and I'm also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of NARO, which is the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. That organization represents about 144 housing authorities around the state, basically all of them, that operate public housing and Section 8 rent assistance, both federally funded programs. Thank you to the committee for holding the hearing. Thank you, Senator Marty, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of your bill. This is a bill that has a primary impact on the MFIP recipients, no question about that, and other witnesses will speak to that. I'm talking about what really is an unintended consequence, I think, of the bill, which is to take money away from the affordable housing system, because in the federally funded programs of Section 8 and public housing, a reduction in the participants' income means they pay less rent. So currently, with $50 being taken out of every month's MFIP check, the resident of public housing or Section 8 pays 30% of income for rent, so they pay $15 less to the housing authority. And that adds up over the course of a year for a large or small agency, over the course of the state. This current law sucks money away from the affordable housing system. And that's the point I was hoping to make in my testimony. I have a handout that has some of the numbers in it. Just to go to the bottom line, less money has an impact one way in public housing, one in Section 8. Section 8 is kind of a closed system. Each housing authority is only authorized to issue a certain number of vouchers. In most years, there's just barely enough money to do that. So if each voucher costs more, say $15 a month because of this housing penalty, then the housing authority cannot issue as many vouchers. Currently, at the $50 a month, we estimate perhaps 150 vouchers statewide are lost because of the $50 penalty. My sheet also has estimates for $100 because the governor actually is proposing to increase the housing penalty to $100 a month. On the public housing side, we can't save money by not renting a unit. We still own it. In extreme cases, my housing authority and several others have had to sell units to permanently reduce the supply, and that does cut some costs over time. But typically, year to year, if we have less operating income from rent or from subsidies, then we simply have to cut back someplace else. Typically, maintenance and housing management are the two big expenses. So it may take a little longer to make a repair on the maintenance side. It may take a little longer to verify somebody's eligibility on the management side or to deal with the tenant problem. So those are the costs, the side costs of the MFIP housing penalty. Be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hester, very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, okay. I would like to make one additional
Senator
comment
Marty.
To that, too, and that is I think most of the public housing agencies in the state are very short of funds for rehab, and they're really suffering for that. So this makes that problem, it aggravates that problem.
Okay. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hester, thank you for your the information on the yellow sheet. I'm really struck by the notation that Minnesota is the only state that penalizes MFIP recipients who live in public housing.
Mr. Hester.
Senator, yes, I'm struck by it, too. I think that's a position Minnesota doesn't like to be in of making a cut in welfare assistance that other states haven't done.
Okay. Looks like we have Ms. Knieche. Is that you? Okay. If you
more
could state,
less.
Okay. If you could state your name for the record and proceed forward with your testimony, be much appreciated.
Thank you very much. My name is Deb Knieche, and I am a member of the Welfare Rights Committee. And I am here as well to speak in support of undoing the $50 cut. This cut, as was said, was imposed in 2003 as a part of the budget deficit or budget balancing that went on that year. It affects 11,000 families in Minnesota. $50 a month comes out of the MFIP grant because of this cut if you live in subsidized housing. $50 a month may not seem like a lot to many people in this room, but if you are a mother with one child, you are receiving $537 a month in welfare. $437 a month in welfare. That is it. A mother with one child. The welfare grants have not been increased in this state for 23 years. We're still living on the same amount as 1986. If you take $50 out of $437, you are left with $387 a month to try and raise your one child on. I don't think that anyone in here can imagine having to be in that situation. This $50 cut concretely decreases, as Mr. Hester said, the amount of affordable housing that is available. We are in a severe economic crisis. People are losing their housing left and right. We should not be doing anything, supporting anything, or continuing anything in law that impacts and decreases the amount of affordable housing that's available. As was also stated, Governor Plenty has proposed increasing this housing cut to $100 a month. So if you're a mother with one child, you would be living on $337 a month. This is outrageous. We need a bill that directly counters the proposal that has been put forward. And this bill, to undo the $50 cut, does exactly that. We're in an economic crisis, and poor and working people are being hit the hardest. Rather than cutting from those of us that are most affected, legislators should be working to undo the damage that was done in 2003 to solve that deficit. And that deficit, by the way, is a deficit that the wealthiest in this state did not pay one dime for. Poor families have been paying dearly for it since 2003, and it's time to undo this $50 cut.
Thank you for that testimony. Any questions from the committee? Senator Marty, any other testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, no, and if there's no further discussion, I'd move this NFL 480 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Mm-hmm.
Any other, anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 480? Okay. Seeing no other testifiers coming forward, the committee now, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 480 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next bill up is Senate File 977, Senator Erickson Ropes. Senator, welcome to the committee. We're glad to have you here, and we're glad to have you be a member of the committee. When you're ready, we'll have you proceed forward with Senate File 977.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm joined here today by Stan Groff from Minnesota Social Services and Jerry Gerber from Department of Human Services, and we've been working on some language on my bill and have an agreement in the form of the A1 amendment, which I'd like to put out there first.
Okay, do we have the A1 amendment in our packet?
No? No, it's being passed out.
Okay. We'll wait. If Senator Erickson Ropes, if you would maybe explain the amendment while we're having it distributed to the committee members, that would be good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the original bill had included additional language using the phrase corporate home, and since corporate home has not been identified in statute anywhere, it makes for a confusing addition. So what we did was remove those words and additionally removed any indication that would. What we're talking about here is child care and foster care for families and children. And what we did was we just took out all the location language. So anyone who's providing child care for children, whether they're foster care, family care, whether they're in a corporate home or a person's private home, it doesn't matter where the location is. We took out all the location. So we're, so that's what our agreement is here, and that's what the A amendment is,
okay.
A1 amendment.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee members on the A1 amendment and A1 author's amendment? Okay. Hearing no comments on that, all members in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Now on Senate File 977 as amended, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. This is a bill that has to do with the Department of Human Services and the background checks that they do with people. In language right now is a 10-year bar and a 7-year bar to set aside any provider if they disqualify, you know, having to do with breaking certain laws. And we're not changing any of those law requirements. All we're doing is saying that no matter where you're providing this care, everyone's on the same playing field and should follow the same rules as far as the set-asides for disqualification. So if you break the law and you work in this location, you should be subject to the same rules of the state as if you work in this location and break the same law. Right now, there is a set of two different standards. So I'll let Stan Groff, who's here with Minnesota Social Services, do a little bit more explanation.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Groff. If you could state your name for the record and then proceed forward with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Stan Groff, and I represent the Minnesota Social Service Association. And prior to that, for nearly 40 years, I was a county human services director. The removal of the defined term provider's home and any reference to corporate homes levels the playing field between private provider homes and corporate homes when it comes to the disqualification of certain felons and misdemeanants from working in those settings and providing care to vulnerable persons. What this fixes is the disparity between those two types of licensed facilities, whereas now there is an increased risk for vulnerable persons in corporate homes where that risk does not reside in family homes. It also takes away the discretion of the commissioner to set aside these disqualifications, and under the, as the senator stated earlier, under law, there should not be a disparity or a difference between the two. Thirdly, it does provide uniformity and levels the playing field for both types of organization or institution. Fourthly, it provides a preventive function in that there is less risk to vulnerable children and adults. And finally, I just want to note that when felons and misdemeanors have served out their time under this statute, they are eligible to again work in this field. So it's not unless it's a certain small subset of persons who are forever barred from service in this field, most of them are eligible to again work in this field. That's the end of my testimony, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Groff. Any questions, Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and with all due respect to the witness, I disagree with this bill, and I believe that we need to reform the whole set-aside law. That we've gone too far in the direction of not allowing people who have been rehabilitated for a period of time that demonstrates their ability to serve in these jobs. We've gone too far in keeping them from being able to work. And there are some of us in the legislature, not just me, but various other people, who've worked long and hard to try to change these laws, and we have not been successful in doing so. That does not mean that we should add more categories to the law. If we're trying to make the law better in terms of fairness to individuals who have been rehabilitated, we should not be adding more categories to a bad law. And so I think there are times when consistency is not a good thing, and I think this is one of them.
Any comments from the testifiers? Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Berglund did talk to me before we came here today, so I understand the concern, and
okay.
I do support needing to look at some of the bars that restrict people from being able to have made a mistake in their life,
right,
and provided a record and are able to prove that they are hireable and should be able to work again. So I would be willing to work on bills that deal with the disqualifications. However, I do believe that when you have inconsistency in how the law is applied in the state, mm-hmm. You really need to deal with that as well. So again, I would say it's just from a purely pragmatic point of view, if you have care being delivered to vulnerable people, whether it's children or adults, the location of where you're providing that care should not prevent you or shield you or be able to have a different standard applied.
Mr. Chairman?
So, I think my bottom line is just the duality of how law is applied.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're saying about fairness, but this whole law isn't fair. That's the point I'm trying to make. The whole law isn't fair, and I would challenge you or anybody else that wants to extend it or broaden it to point to one instance, just one, where the commissioner has approved a set-aside inappropriately. I think the department did a good job with set-asides. And I, you know, first of all, in order to be able to even ask the commissioner for a set-aside, you have to have an employer who believes that you've been rehabilitated and would be a good person to hire. So that's a bar right there. Then the next thing is the commissioner looks at the individual case, looks at the record, looks at how long ago the crime occurred and what the circumstances around the crime were, and then they decide if they're going to set aside a disqualification. And I challenge you to find a time when the commissioner didn't do that properly.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund's really been an advocate for trying to figure out how to fix some of these things. For example, it says in here that if you had been convicted of rioting, you never, from my understanding, could be in the child care business. Seems to me it wasn't that long ago there were riots in at the Dinky Town, after a hockey game. And any of those people who got arrested there, they were young and stupid. It wasn't that they were doing something that would make it so that, that somehow that affects a profession. The whole premise of this is just really turned on its ear, and I'd be tempted to just repeal the whole section, but I'm not sure that's the simple answer probably isn't the best answer, and we need to do some serious work on this section of law. These set asides or the whole bar is crazy.
Understand we have another testifier here. If you could state your name for the record and then proceed forward with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division at the Department of Human Services. And we do a lot of background studies under this law, and we disqualify a lot of people. And we're the ones that process the reconsideration requests that are at issue here. And I'm here today. I just want to thank Senator Erickson-Ropes for the amendment. The amendment makes a number of technical changes that if the committee were to pass this bill, this would be the shape it should be in. So thank you for that. I'm really here just to answer questions about the background study process or the system that may come up.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Any further questions? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unlike some of the rest of my colleagues here on the table, I'm really brand new to all this. So this set-aside, is that to give an exception to someone being disqualified? I don't know who could answer that.
Okay. Yes.
And then my follow-up question is, in Section 2, so I look at the 7-year bar, it says something about individuals who committed an act that constitute maltreatment of a child or maltreatment resulting in substantial bodily harm. Do we want to ever make an exception to someone having a job that would deal with children or vulnerable adults if they've done something that constitutes as maltreatment or substantial bodily harm? Do we want any kind of set aside or exceptions to that? To me, it seems like they should be barred completely from ever doing any additional work.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, on the face of it, you might come to that conclusion, but when you look at individual cases, you might come to an entirely different conclusion. And I can just about guarantee you that if you're around here for any length of time, you will have a constituent who tries to get a job, who's had something happen in their past for which you yourself would say, that shouldn't be held against this person any longer. And that's why we've had the ability of the commissioner to look at individual cases and make a decision to set something aside. And, they review it from time to time, too. It's not just set aside forever. It has to get renewed periodically. And so, I just think it's a better way to deal with it.
Thank you.
Anybody else? I think it's Mr. McAfee, correct?
Yes.
Would like to testify on this. Step up to the table and state your name for the record and proceed forward with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark McAfee. I'm legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. And regarding this particular bill, while it is true we represent some folks that work in county licensing and they'd probably like to have consistency in what they deal with, I come here today. We represent folks that work in the MSOX homes, group homes. My understanding is this. You would think by looking at, Mr. Chair, members, the term corporate home, you'd think it's, you know, private daycare centers, corporate. But apparently, my understanding is it could affect MSOX homes as well. And we would, in conjunction with that, we would have to oppose this bill as it's proposed. Some of the reasons have been cited. We've had cases where my understanding is basically a background check is done, and then once there's a disqualification comes in, there's a 60-day appeal period. If we have any of our members, we put out the word that you know they've got to hit that 60-day appeal. If they don't appeal within 60 days, that's it. But then there's an appeals process, and in checking with some of our staff at et cetera, we've had cases where we've had people who are chemically dependent, and then they may have committed some crime earlier, and now they've, you know, perhaps that was 10 years ago or so, and now they've worked in a group home for 8 years or so. They were chemically dependent, but they've become sober or clean. And we think, therefore, that while it's true that we, first and foremost, we want to prevent abuse of vulnerable persons, that we think that the commissioner should have the authority to look at things on a case-by-case basis. Because as been stated by some of the members, in certain cases there may be somebody who is now, in effect, a different person, or they're rehabilitated in some sense. So, and if you want to look at consistency, then I think you'd have to perhaps examine the whole law. And, you know, if you pushed me to say we've got to come out of here with a consistent bill, well, then I'd say lighten it up for those that aren't affected, rather than tightening it down and making it impossible for folks. Not everyone that appeals is certainly set aside. I think the commissioner staff certainly don't want to be, they don't want that on them that they're letting somebody through. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members to Mr. McAfee? Seeing no questions, anybody else want to testify on Senate File 977? Seeing nobody, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Mr. Chair, I, hearing the tone of the committee and recommendations today, I request to lay the bill aside.
Okay. The committee will lay the bill aside then.
Thank you.
Then we'll proceed forward with Senate File 978, and that's Senator Erickson-Ropes. So if you can go ahead and whenever you're ready, Senator, proceed forward with your bill.
We have the same group of people.
Okay.
With another bill. This has to do with training requirements for shaken baby syndrome. And after looking at the law, we decided that shaken baby syndrome should be the people that need training on that issue should not just only be people caring for infants, but also young children, because young children can also be affected by shaken baby syndrome. So we're talking about some training requirements. I have the A1 amendment that tightens up the definition of which age children we want to be targeting.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, is that your explanation of the A1 amendment?
Yeah, the only difference between the bill and the amendment is that in the bill it says young children up to five years of age. There's a question about whether that includes 5 years of age. So the new language says children through 5 years of age.
Any questions from the committee members on the author's A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Erickson Ropes on Senate File 978 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've broken down some of the training requirements. There are some providers who take care of infants alone, and it's believed that they don't need to go through, or they need to go through the SID training and shaken baby training. But for providers who are only taking care of older children, they don't need to do the SIDS training because the children they're taking care of are beyond that age break. And so I'll have once again, Mr. Groff, walk you through the bill with more explanation.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is
Mr.
Stan
Groff.
I represent the Minnesota Social Service Association. This bill does require the training for staff who care for infants and young children. And it's a combination of both SIDS training as well as shaken baby syndrome. It covers licensed foster care, chemical dependency treatment programs serving children and small children, family child care centers, and corporate child care centers. Those are daycare centers. What this fixes is age differences in the law among the various providers. And the way it plays out in actuality is that some are required with a cutoff of 6 months, some at 2 years, and some at 5 years. What this does is it makes it uniform throughout the law through age five. It provides for clarity and uniformity in the law among all of these providers where children are affected, and it expands a considerable number of covered children up through 5 years of age. That's my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Groff. Any questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, for the author, Mr. Groff, I'm just curious. I know several years
ago Mr. Chair, not Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble seeing.
Yeah. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I remember it seems to be 5-10 years ago there seemed to be almost a rash of shaken baby things and so on, and I wondered how many people are getting training right now through this sort of thing, and has that contributed to, is there a decrease in number of shaken baby incidents? Because it seems to me we're not hearing it as much in the news. We're getting progress on this issue because of the training, you think?
Mr. Groff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, my own belief is that the shaken baby, this is anecdotal and subjective, but that shaken baby training has had a positive influence, and that we, in fact, are having less reports, but I cannot cite statistics.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Perhaps Mr. Kerber, the Department of Human Services, could.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services. Senator Marty, I'm not sure that we have data on that. Anecdotally, it seems that we're having fewer. The training that went into effect a few years ago, it was kind of around the same time that we had more training on sudden infant death syndrome. And certainly those numbers have gone down. But I'm not sure about the shaken baby syndrome. Right now, the training is only required for people who serve infants, and so this will make the training required for more folks. But I'm not sure what those numbers are.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kerber, I guess the group that I'm a little bit concerned about getting pulled in with this language would be the people doing before and after school care, because 5 years old is the kind of threshold for going to school. And so most of the children would be 5 years old or older. And if we're going through age five, then that would bring in a whole bunch of providers that haven't previously been included in the training. And I'm not sure, one, if it's going to be that productive, and number two, I'm a little bit worried about the costs to the providers of getting all of their people trained, especially in a year when we might not be continuing to provide them with the same amount of money that they've had in the past.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I think that's, and again, I have to thank Senator Erickson Ropes for her agreement on the amendment that we offered her. What we're trying to do is address that very issue. On, if you look in the child care sections of the bill, that's one of the things that got changed, is that we're specifically using terminology from the child care world. And so that these are the people who are required to have the training are the people who are serving children under school age. And so it isn't going to affect those people who do only before and after school programs.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might ask Senator Erickson Ropes, shaken baby syndrome, is there a penalty for, you know, was it a gross misdemeanor if you're found shaking a baby when it's in your care? Do you know?
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Groff will take that question.
Mr. Groff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, when that occurs, it becomes a legal matter, and it goes to the courts, and so the normal criminal processes apply.
Mr. Chair, then
Senator Dahl,
there is a law in place though that handles that those infractions. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Groff,
Senator, as far as I know.
Okay, I'm just, and the reason I'm asking, Mr. Chair, is that we're talking about means to reduce the risk of shaking. I mean, there should be, to me, absolutely no reason why someone should shake a baby. I mean, it should be a never ever to give training as to why you shouldn't or to reduce the risk. It just be, if you do this, you're violating the law. You're going to go to jail or whatever. You're committing a crime. Now the sudden infant death syndrome, I understand. That's a different issue, and let's train some people on reducing the risks involved with that. And I don't know if a half an hour is long enough time to really, you know, give people a sufficient training if they're going to be dealing with children and threat, especially if they've got multiple children in their care. But the shaken baby syndrome, it seems to me, it's like that should be straightforward, that, you know, it's a crime and it can't be committed, and that we shouldn't really be just looking at ways to reduce the risk. So I don't know if it's just a matter of the language or what, but my comment on this.
Well, Senator Dahl, a couple of years ago there was some legislation passed that I believe that the family had to have this education requirement when they had a baby, and I think Mr. Groff is saying that the department believes that that was helpful. So, Mr. Groff, you want to comment on that, or Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, there is somebody here from the department who can speak to the content of the training, but one of the things that's addressed in the training is the situation under which people are more prone to shake an infant, And sometimes family child care providers or any child care provider who has a room full of kids may be at wit's end. One of the things it does is it teaches people how to recognize that situation and how they're feeling at that time, and then teach them some alternatives. And sometimes it's simply like call up somebody, get on the phone and call somebody and tell them to come over right away. You know, it's that kind of thing that's involved in the training. It's helping people, coping mechanisms, I guess.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That helps.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Yep, Mr. Chair, there's also someone here from the Traumatic Brain Injury Association if they'd like to speak to the bill as well.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and your title for the committee record, we'd sure appreciate it, and then proceed forward with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Michelle Grave, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Michelle Grave. Work in public policy at the Brain Injury Association. And I think I'd like to make a quick comment, if I could, surrounding the training. And Senator Dahl, you mentioned like a drastic shaking, of course, would be considered more of a legal matter. And I think part of the training as well is understanding how delicate brain matter is, and how understanding, especially in infancy through 5 years of age, transferring to a high chair at toddler age or transferring to different areas, that it's just so playing with other kids, it's so sensitive, and so there's a lot more to be recognizable. And you know, the Brain Injury Association is the largest organization for advocacy and referral for folks with brain injury. And 100,000 is estimated suffer traumatic or brain injury, both acquired and traumatic, in the state of Minnesota. And shaken baby syndrome is traumatic brain injury is an often occurrence with a severe shaken baby syndrome.
Senator Dahl.
If I might just comment on that, I agree that it's the traumatic brain injury. I don't think most people are going to be that's going to occur transferring children from one chair to another. Kids fall down all the time and bang their head on the floor. I've got plenty of them around that have done it and get right back up and keep going. I think the shaken baby issue is a deliberate act that maybe they're out of control, but it takes a serious amount of force to cause some injuries that we're talking about. And maybe in some cases it won't be as much force, but it's still a deliberate act to me. And I don't know. I mean, I appreciate that it's more about trying to catch the symptoms or the signs before you get to that point, but I think that's the first thing is let people know that this is a serious crime.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Chair, and then Senator Dahl, to your other point about just is a half an hour enough time to spend on training, we came up with the half hour because it used to be in statute or requirement that you do 1 hour of training that covers SIDS and shaken baby. So if we're dividing this into groups where you have people who don't ever deal with one, they only have to have half the training. So that's why we came up with 30 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee members? Seeing anybody else want to testify on this bill? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just a question for Mr. Kerber or Ms. Gray. I think some of the witnesses had the same sense that anecdotally that there has been a reduction. Mm-hmm. Perhaps because of this training. I was just curious if there is any place where anybody would track this that we could find numbers on that.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, there's a mortality review committee at the Department of Human Services that might have some of that information. It's not always well current, but I could follow up on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not looking for a lot, but if you could spend 5 minutes just seeing if there is anything, because it sure seems anecdotally that there has been a reduction.
Thank you. Any further comments? Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Groff.
Oh, okay, Groff. Getting too Chairman. Many people up there for me.
For sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I used to sit on the Child Mortality Review Committee as a county director a while back, and we only dealt with deceased children, and of course, as a previous testifier indicated, there's a whole bunch of folks who don't pass from that very issue. My own request would be that somehow, like you, we find out what the numbers are.
Mm-hmm. Senator Erickson Ropes, what's your pleasure on your bill here?
I'd like to move the bill as amended.
All right. Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate file 978 as amended be recommended to pass. And it's my understanding that that will go right to the Senate floor. Is that right? That is right. So all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
No further business to come before this committee. We're adjourned.